Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 4th of Tevet. This is a response from Mishpatei Uziel, the 4th volume, Choshen Mishpat Siman Membet, the response number 42. It's dated the 4th of Tevet of Tuf Reish Tzadichet, which was still in December of 1937. As another example, we saw this from Rav Cook recently as well, as another example of people dating their tshuvot at the time without worrying about the fact that the date Tuf Reish Tzadichet spells an acronym of a word that refers to murder. So that later people, I think, maybe looking back on it, turned it around. But apparently both neither Rav Cook nor Rav Uziel felt the need to change the date. So it's from 1937. He was asked a bunch of questions by the Poel, the Va'ad HaPoel, meaning the executive committee of the Poel HaMizrahi. So Poel HaMizrahi was a group of labor Zionists, and they wanted to know about relations between employers and employees. And he says, you know, each of your questions are really very important. They really require and should and deserve a great investigation into it, looking into it. With a lot of details, but because I don't want to take up too much of your time, I'm going to write very briefly. So it is a reminder, not just here, but in lots of places, that when we talk about issues and we raise issues, very often we raise them and we don't keep in mind the breadth of material that could address this topic. We just sort of think, I know two sources, I know three sources, and therefore I can come to a conclusion. And people like Rav Uziel, and even more so Rav Vadya Yosef, they are struggling to help people find real answers. They're not looking to just go into things for the sake of going things and to go on at length for no good reason. But even as they're looking for real answers and practical answers and some limit, they also have a wealth of knowledge to them that they honestly believe is relevant to the discussion and needs to be part of the discussion. So that's, Rav Uziel is much less of a problem for him. He, I think, was even more skilled at restricting himself. Rav Yosef would sometimes go on, but he would restrict himself and be relatively brief. But it's a reminder that we shouldn't think that everything we hear from him is all he had to say on the topic. It's what he picked out as the most relevant. So he says, but I can't just tell you straight out answers, because he says, Chovat kol meshiv, it is the obligation of every respondent. And this is an obligation that I think many meshivim, many respondents take seriously, but it's worth our while to know that that's the way respondents see their job. Meaning they don't think their job is to just tell us what the answer is. Their job is, as Rav Uziel says, the va'er mikor ha-halakha b'talmud u'poskim, to tell us not only what to do, but how we know it. Is it a pasuk of the Torah? Is it a gemara? Which gemara is it? How did the poskim, how did the authorities who rule on these issues take it? And also to give some reasoning of it. That's what an answer in halakha is supposed to be. And then he says, and I want to say also, this is my opinion. He says this a lot. I have no idea. You know, I unfortunately and sadly never met the man. But in all of his tshuva, a great humility comes out. He frequently starts tshuva by saying, a response by saying, you know, you thought this, and then you asked my opinion. You know, who am I? But you asked my opinion, so because you asked, I'll tell you my opinion. So it doesn't stop him from expressing strong opinions, but it does. It's a current in his thought. It comes up all the time. So he says, I'm just telling you what I thought of and what seemed to me the proper definitions of the answers to your questions, which was, what are good relations in halacha between employers and employees? So he answers, I don't have anything specific about employers and employees in halacha that I found, but I think that it's an argument a fortiori. It's a kal vachomer, it's a mikol shekein. I can show you something, he says, about a slave. So if I could show it to you about a slave, it's all the more so for an employee. So this, I think he's right. I don't mean to question him at all, but I mean to point out then that part of the reason why it's reasonable for him to say this, I think, is that when we talk about Eved Ivri, we use the English word slave, and it's really inappropriate. Because an Eved Ivri is somebody who's sold for a time that he can't get out of it, but that's pretty much all that makes him a slave. And the owner has certain rights. It's not an owner. It's much more, I think an indentured servant is a much better way of expressing it. It's much closer to what the halakhic phenomenon is of what we call an Eved Ivri, where we would translate it as slave. So in that context of what I will call an indentured servant, the Torah says, ki macher, when your brother Jew is, so Yimacher now will be, is sold, but not sold in terms of ownership, sold in terms of indentured servitude, which is a kind of sale as well. So the Sifra in Vayikra says, so how do you work out? It says, Ha'achicha, Ha'achicha, Ha'achicha. It'll be sold to you, but he's your brother. The pasuk refers to him as your brother. So the Sifra says, how does that work? Atanogea bo achva, you have to treat him like a brother, and he has to treat himself like an oved, like an eved, like an indentured servant. So that means, Rav Uziel says, the employers, the owner of the indentured servant, or the I don't even know what it's called. I don't think it's called an owner. So I just looked it up. Indentured servitude was generally for people who wanted to make it to a different country and to the U.S. basically. They were brought and they had to serve 4 to 7 years. And they were treated harshly sometimes, but they weren't slaves. And the country was 4 to 7 years. And then they could go. So that's much more similar to the Torah system of an Eved Ivri. And the person is called an employer. Okay, so the employer of the indentured servant. So here, back in our pasuk, the employer, the person himself has to treat himself, the Sifra says, as an indentured servant, has to see himself as an unfree laborer who has to labor for the owner. And the owner, Habi'alim, Chayavim Avdim B'midat Ava V'Chavot Ayin Tov V'Nidivut Lev. That's what Rav Uziel says. The employers have to see these people as their brethren. So you have a brother who's working for you for whatever reason, you have to treat him, he says, with love and awe and respect, and a generosity of spirit and of heart. Whereas the poel, the laborer, has to work faithfully and with complete mesirut nefesh. He has to really devote himself or herself to the job. That's what Rav Uziel understands, and then he's going to elaborate. So what would the expression of the ahava v'kavod, what would be the honor and the love and respect and honor from the side of the employer? So the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin that based on a pasuk that says, ki tov lo imach, that it's got to be good with you for the employee, the Gemara says, imach b'ma'achal, that he has to eat with you and drink with you, whatever you get, the food you get, the drink you get, you have to share with him. So the Gemara actually ends up saying that buying an Eved Ivri is like buying an owner, because you have so many rules for having to make sure to treat them. So the harshness that I mentioned in American indentured servitude isn't supposed to be there. So Rav Uziel says, you learn from this that you have to treat this indentured servant like an equal. Not that halachically he or she is an equal, right? Halachically, it's really a he. Halachically, he is an unfree laborer, but your attitude towards him and the way you treat him has to be like, here's a person who's joining me in my work, however that happened, and now is an equal of mine joining me in my work, and you can't insult him, you can't embarrass him. And then Rav Uziel throws in, and this is a very interesting idea that we don't always think about, he says, ki b'otah midah shel yitzkak ha'poel Labal, kach kabal abayit ela poel. The same way that the indentured servant needs the work, and that's why the indentured servant agreed to the contract, so he clearly needs the work, and so we're going to get to regular laborers in a second, but the person who bought that contract needs laborers. And the same way that one needs the work, one needs the laborers. Now, it happens to be that the one who the employer, the one who bought the contract, the one who bought the Eved Ivri's work for those years, does need laborers, but it's probably true that he could find laborers more easily than this laborer could find work, because the contract isn't exactly an equal contract. One is agreed to indentured servitude. But Rav Uziel, I think, is saying that what the Sifra is telling us is that the attitude of the employer needs to be, I needed an employee, this is the employee I found, this is my employee, fine, but other than that, it's a fellow Jew. And I have to always keep that in mind as I employ my fellow Jew. So to what's Ayin Tova Nedivut Lev, the employer says, Rav Uziel, that you can't be too exacting with your employees. That way you wouldn't be with family members, with friends, right? You have to observe what the pasuk in Mishlei says. Mishlei 2:20 says, "Leman tilech b'derech tovim." You should go in the ways of good people, ve'orchot tzadikim tishmor, and observe the paths of the righteous. Which means we should be better people. We should be better than required. So it might be true that by some pure legal account, an owner of an indentured servant, somebody who owns the contract and the labor of the indentured servant, has the right to be mean to him, right? And if he shows up late, if he doesn't do the work right, you could, let's say, theoretically, hit the employee, let's say. But it doesn't matter what that you could theoretically and halachically and legally do, because what Rav Uziel is pointing out is that also halachically, based in Mishle, we have this idea that the owner, the Baal HaBayit, the employer, should be acting better than that, should be acting at a higher level. And then the Gemara in Bava Metzia 83:8 tells an interesting story about Rabba Bar Bar Chana. Had some people transporting an item for him, and they, as they were transporting it, they broke it, and he took their clothing. He took. They were very poor. The poverty in the time of the Gemara is something that people don't pay attention to, right? If you think about it, and this is not Raziel talking, it just it always strikes me that we, you know, when you're listening to this, we'll just have gone through Hanukkah. The Gemara has whole sugyot about if somebody doesn't have the money to get both Hanukkah candles and wine for Kiddush, or both Hanukkah candles and Shabbos candles. So we're talking about an amount of money to get a little bit of oil to light a candle that will last for half an hour for Hanukkah, plus that will light for a few hours at night, and that's money that was really beyond, it was enough beyond people that it became a halachic question to talk about. So here too, these laborers, these people transporting this item for Rabba Bar Bar Chana were so poor, they had nothing. So when they broke the item for him, he wanted to collect from them the value of the item. They broke his item. He wanted it to pay back. So he took their clothing, I think. So they take him to a din before Rav. And Rav says, give him back their clothing. So he says to him, Rabba Bar Chana says, is that the halacha? So he says to him, yes, because of the verse, Lematilek Medechtovim, you have to act in a better way than perhaps the strict law would say. So he gives him back their clothing. And then they say to Rav, you know, we're very poor, we work the whole day, and we're hungry, and we don't have anything. And he says, give them their salary, give them their money. He says, that's the halacha. So Rav says to him, yes, because the end of that pasuk is, V'rachot tzadikim kishmor. In other words, Rav is saying to Rabbi Barakana, that I know you, and you are a good enough person, and you are a financially stable enough person, that you should not be trying to go by any kind of strict law, whatever the law would be. When you treat your employees, you have to treat them in an open and giving way, as much as you can. Rav Uziel is saying, that's clearly true, should be clearly true, in our times as well. That should be the fundamental attitude. Now, this gets complicated, right? This, you know, if we're assuming for a second the Rabba Bar Chana, that the amounts of money involved for Rabba Bar Bar Chana were insignificant, and for the employees were significant. So then we see easily why we would say to Rabba Bar Bar Chana, yes, you have to live to a higher standard. I think it becomes more of a challenge in a business that's not so, or a businessman or an employer who's not so successful. There are employers who, by the standards of the employees, are very, very wealthy. But by the standards of the business, it's not necessarily hanging together so well. It's on the verge of bankruptcy sometimes, and employees don't see that, don't know. So I think these are not such simple issues. But Uziel is making an extremely important and valid point that employers should not see their employees as slaves. They should see them as equals. They should see them as people whose labor they have purchased for a certain period of time. We'll get to those issues in a minute. And treat them with that kind of respect and go beyond what's absolutely required of them if occasion arises. On the other hand, says Rav Uziel, the worker, the laborer, the employee, has to realize that by selling his or her time for the job, by taking on the job, it means that he or she has taken on a real responsibility. It's his responsibility to put in all of the physical and intellectual power that he has to help the Baal HaBayit. Now, this comes up in American law a lot, and some of this becomes a question of what's assumed and what's understood in the time between employer and employee and what the employer really wants and expects. And Rav Uziel is going to talk about minhag hamakom, minhag ha'ir, the custom in a certain place, in a minute. So we'll get to that. So his rules are going to be what his understanding was of the Gemara's understanding of what the relationship should be, and then and from there, you'd move on. But in the Gemara's time, the Gemara's assumption was, you know, if I work a 9-to-5 job, it still means I'm owned 9-to-5. And that would mean, to put it in terms of our day, let's say at 10:30, I get a phone call from a relative who wants to talk about, you know, the family get-together this Sunday. So halachically, I'm not allowed to take that call, except that in our times, I think the answer is, in our times, the assumption between among everybody is that's not the way we work it, that we don't treat our employees like that. So if, even if I'm an employee and I have a job, my job is to get the job done. It's true. I have to be here certain hours and I have to work hard as I can. But if I take a minute or two or this, so all those are complicated questions just because the Gemara assumed completely different. And there is a story in Ta'anit, Chav Gimel and Aleph going on to Amud Bet about Abba Chilkiah, who was a grandson of Choni HaMe'agel and also had great powers in terms of bringing rain. And there's a whole story in the Gemara there about when they wanted him to bring rain. They needed him to bring rain. There was a drought in Eretz Israel and they sent two people to him to pray for rain. And there's a whole long story where he does all these strange things. But among the strange things that he did, that he later explains to them after the rain comes, they later explains to them. So among the strange things that he did was he didn't say anything to them. He's working all day. He didn't say a word to them. And then when the day was over, they follow him, he invites them back to his house. So among the things he said to him was, why is it you didn't say hello to us? He said, because I'm working for somebody else. I don't have the time. I'm not allowed to. So that attitude towards labor, even if it's not exactly required in our time because of the understanding among employees and employers, is an attitude that Rav Uziel is bringing up to say that the employee should see him herself fundamentally that way. We also have another halacha, that there are many situations where people are supposed to stand for other people, where they're supposed to say hello. So let's say an elderly person walks by, the halacha and the Torah is that we stand before elderly people. So the Gemara says, however, that if you have tradesmen, workers, who are working for other people, and their job, and they've hired on for other people, they're not allowed to stop and stand up for people, for elders, while they're doing it, because their time is their own, and they're not. So that's what I would have thought of as a completely insignificant amount of time, and yet they have to worry about that. They have to do that. He points out also that how the halacha was in the time of the Gemara, that workers who are on a job would not say the fourth bracha of benching. So the Gemara doesn't want us to talk about this a lot, but the first three brachot of benching, the bracha of Hazanat HaKol and Al Haaretz Al HaMazon and Bnei Yerushalayim, those are understood to be brachot d'oraita. Those are a part of the benching the Torah set up, the brachot HaMazon the Torah set up. And that fourth bracha of HaTov HaMeitiv, that bracha was the Gemara says, Dirabanan, was set up rabbinically after certain tragedies happened that we wanted to and the aftermath of them in which some good came of them. So Chazal set up that bracha as part of benching. But they said that employees who are paid by the hour, who are working for a job and have come to the owner and have an employer whose time now belongs to them, are not required to say that fourth bracha in benching. So again, I think today we would say it anyway because it's in the context of today and significant amount of time, but it's an attitude towards being an employee that isn't always out there. And that's what Rav Uziel is stressing. And not only is it true of time, he says it's also true of the person's physical ability. It's the person's ability to give time to the employee. It's to give all of his power to the employer, because that's what he signed on for. He signed on to give him his best work. And as the Rambam writes, that an employee is not allowed to do what he wants at night, melachto balayla, laskiras mo bayom, and then to hire himself out during the day. Now, this is a thorny halachic topic that we'd have to talk about a lot. The Rav Uziel doesn't go into it at length. He's saying it as a general principle. So let's say I have a 9-to-5 job. Can I go to school at night? So you might think, well, my time is my own. But the Rambam is saying is, well, but if I go to school at night and I'm studying and I'm up till 3 a.m, and I drag myself out of bed at 7:30 and then go to work all day 9-to-5, but I'm groggy all day, the Rambam says that's not allowed. The reason it's not allowed is because I hired myself to be my best employee. So that means, and the Rambam adds, you can't also, this person, you can have people who are in very struggling, in very difficult situations, and this halakha would still apply, you can't starve yourself and give food to your children. So what happens if there's just not enough food to go around? What do you do about it? It's a hard question, and you do what you can. But the Rambam's point is that part of the obligation, the part of the calculus there has to be that if a person has hired themselves out to the Baal HaBayit, to an employer, they've committed to giving that employer their best work. Right? So if they've committed to giving, and this is where the Rambam mentions that fourth bracha in Perkei Mazon. And so then I have to do my best to give my best work. Now today people would say, well, I can get by on 4.5 hours. The question is, what's your best work that you are hired out for and how well are you doing? And I think these aren't obvious and simple things. And Yaakov HaTzadik says to his wives, you know, I worked for your father with all of my best ability. So the poll has to do that, the employer has to do that, and the Rav Uziel adds, has to do it be'ava v'chavod l'mavid. It has to have a certain respect, it has to have love for the employer, because the employer is keeping this person alive, it's keeping this person in a job. This doesn't happen a lot, people often resent their employers. He says, and not like a machine, or even not like a mitzuvah osa, oh, I hired on, so I have to do that, or somebody who, oh, I just need the money. But like a partner in the endeavor. So that's a fascinating comment on your experience. This is 1930s, so maybe it's changed, but it's a fascinating insight into what it should be. It should be that you feel like you're part of something, you're part of an endeavor, you've hired on to it. It's true, you're doing it for the money. But as you do, after you're doing it for the money, if you've agreed on the amount of money, and this is what you're getting, so you might think, I'm not getting enough of it. This doesn't matter. You have to see yourself as you're working for the benefit of your employer, and you're working, he says, you're building up Eretz Yisrael. So that's not true elsewhere, but in other places, you're building up wherever the world is. So he's saying that's supposed to be the attitude of the employee. The employee is supposed to know and understand and remember that even if our work seems like a private, silly, stupid thing, it's part of building up an economy and a world, and it's part of our obligations as people to do it. And then as the world gets better, then we get better. So he's talking about in Eretz Yisrael's terms, in terms of Israel in particular, that's even more so. And it's not a matter of, he says, not a matter, and this is something you lose in a capitalist society, but he says, not a matter only of how much money you make or how much physical pleasure you get. It's that we're part of building up the world and making a full place. And we should love that and be happy for that. And then the employer is giving us this opportunity. And I can tell you, as somebody who has not worked at a formal job for a long time, it's a very difficult thing sometimes, right? So thank God the money has been an issue, because I live with somebody who makes, thank God, God sends us many blessings. But being part of something and being able to feel like you're contributing to the building of the world, he says that's an important thing too, and the employee should have some gratitude towards the employer for having developed that and given that opportunity, and to feel good about it, and to feel like he is part or she is part of building that kind of thing, and that's what it should be. So there should be this kind of mutual relationship between employer and employee, and they should love each other and respect each other and give honor to each other in all of these terms. Doesn't always work out that way, and the next parts of the tshuva will take up times when it doesn't go out that way. So the question was, what would be considered onah, meaning let's say an employer gives too little to the employee. So in purchases, if I overcharge you, if the seller overcharges the buyer, that's onah, that's a violation of the Torah. If the buyer underpays somehow, by a, that's also onah. So here, let's say that the employer says, I'll pay you $5 an hour, and the job is really worth $10 an hour, or that's the standard, and I find a way, the employer, unfortunately, finds a way to cheat the employee. So Rav Uziel says, it's not considered onah halachically, because halachically, the technical monetary idea of onah applies only to buying and selling objects. But even so, if one cheated the other, or even another possibility is, let's say I hire somebody and we have a contract, and then the value of that labor goes up tremendously somehow. So an example that popped to my mind is, let's say you hire on to the NBA, you sign a 5-year contract, then all of a sudden the NBA is awash in TV money, so there's all this money out there, and all these other players who are at your level are getting much more money than you're getting. So today, that's why players build in opt-outs into their contracts in case that should happen and things like that. So let's say there is no opt-out, and you just didn't make a mistake, and you've got a 10-year contract, and you were happy with the contract when you signed it, but now there are people making 15, 20, whatever, lots more money. So in the NBA, for those kinds of people, it's not perhaps a tragedy, but you can have the same thing. Let's say I hired on for a job, and I hired on a minimum wage, so I'm not making a lot of money. I'm struggling to get by. Minimum wage is, $8 an hour, but I signed the contract. The contract didn't say I get whatever the minimum wage is, so they get $8 an hour. And then, not legally, they don't lift the minimum wage. If they lifted it legally, I would just get the minimum wage. But then, all of a sudden, everybody around me, all the guys who are on the same assembly line as I am, are getting $20 an hour. So halakhically, it doesn't matter, he says. I signed on. You can't force change in the contract either way, right? Let's say all of a sudden the value of this job goes down because it became automated and you can do it for much cheaper. Either way, neither side can change a contract that's been signed until the contract is over. But if one side is cheating the other or has done it on purpose, knowing they would get away with something, so there is a violation of ona'ah on a verbal level. The halakhic assumption is that ona'ah is not only cheating financially, but even mistreating people verbally is considered an ona'ah to devarim, and this, he says, would certainly fall under that category. Then who decides what the hours of work are? Rav Uziel says, midin Torah, by Torah law, the hours of work are, and this is based on the Pasuk of Tehillim, two Pesukim in Tehillim that refer to Tizrach HaShemesh Ye'el Seifun, is Tehillim 104:22, when the sun rises or shines, they gather together, and then the next verse has Yitzei Adam Lefa'alo V'Lavado Ad Arev, and he leaves his work when night comes. So Medin Torah, he says, work is from sun, from the sun shines, I'm pretty sure he means sunrise, until it's dark. So Ade Arev, you could have thought meant when the sun sets, but he assumes, I'm not doubting him, he assumes that it's when the stars come out. That would be the time you have to work. That would mean you'd have more time in the summer and less time in the winter. But he says also, the included in that time is commuting time. So it's not that you have to be at work by sunrise, it's that you have to leave your house then. And also the time for davening in a shul, which is an interesting comment, especially since there are many people who don't even bother to go to minyan. He's saying the right to go to minyan is so serious that even though an employee is supposed to be on the job or commuting to the job at sunrise, time to go to minyan has to be included in that. And if you were going to build a Jewish state following Rav Uziel's rules, you'd then have to see when there were minyanim around and include that in the time. And also time for meals. And time, he says, on Fridays, on Erev Yom Tov, to prepare for Shabbos. And that's the time al pi din Torah. Then he says, though, it all changes depending on the minhag ha-makom, depending on your place. Now, I think he means that if it's less, then it's less. I don't think he means you can decide that people don't go to minyan. I think he meant to say minyan, going to minyan is an absolute right of the employee and you shouldn't stop him from that. But if there are other things that come up, so let's say people decide it's 9 to 5 instead, so minag mevatel halacha, then you can have this Yerushalmi and Bava Metzila that he quotes, then if the local custom comes up, then that can get rid of the of a halacha, and therefore if everybody works only 9 to 5, then the owner can't say, I want you in the job from sunrise, I want you starting to commute at sunrise and I'll let you go at when the stars come out. Not only that, he says you can't require more hours than are regularly expected, even if you pay more money. Then he says if you didn't make that condition to begin with. So that becomes a question also of minhag ha-makom. If it's what I remember, people told me when they, hired on to be lawyers, they said, listen, they pay us a lot of money in the law, but part of the reason they pay us this money is because our time is in our own all the time. So if you have to stay one night till 3 a.m., that's known ahead of time. A lot of times there are contracts that talk about what will happen with overtime. But Rav Uziel is saying you can't force somebody to do overtime unless it was included in the original agreement. Then he says, once you're in a job, in the job, I keep talking about signing a contract, but I think he also would have included, if I hire somebody open-endedly, and we don't have a specific term of employment, so he says you also can't change the conditions in terms of the hours in the middle, even if some reason comes up. So even if he's saying, I have a factory and we have to get some product out or something went wrong and we have a big contract to fill, he says you can't force the employees to stay longer. And if you're trying to change the conditions that they're worried now, you might be careful enough to put this in ahead of time. And this is where you get lawyers, right? Because lawyers remind you of all the things that you want to set up ahead of time so it'll be part of the legal contract. So that's what Vazil is, he's not saying that part of it, but he's saying anything that's not included in the original, then you can't require it of somebody. So if it's not required, you can't force them to do it. Then he gets into a strike. He was asked, you're allowed to go on strike. He says he thinks a strike isn't A, permitted, and B, it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea for the poel, for the employee, because every day that he's not working, remember that he thinks the work is noble and obligatory as a human being, so you're just wasting a day of your life. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're not fulfilling your job, and you're supposed to be doing a job. And it's not good for the owner, because any endeavor, whether it's construction or industry or planting or agriculture, all these things are pressing, and if you lose a day of them, that's a loss you can never get back. So a strike really hurts everybody involved. And therefore, you can't do it. And sort of a related idea is the Gemara talks about, let's say an employee decides in the middle of an agreed day that he can't do the work anymore. Halacha is he's allowed to leave in the middle because the pasuk says that we are only slaves to Hashem, not to anybody else. And if the employer could force him to stay, other than an Eved Ivri, the employer could absolutely force the employee to stay. That would be a form of avdut, just that inability to leave even in the middle of a job. So then they said, however, but if it was something that the employer will have an irrevocable loss, then the employee is not allowed to leave. Because that's not a question of slavery. That's a question of he signed on to something and he's going to damage the employer by leaving. So just by the way, if Ravuziel is saying that everything is considered an irrevocable loss, it would mean that no employees could leave. But he doesn't mean that. He means that there's things that are obviously irrevocable losses, but then there are things that aren't so irrevocable, and there the employees could leave, but it's not a good idea because they're causing damage to the owner. And the Ramah and the Beis Yosef had agreed that the definition of a loss that you can't get back for the owner is anything he can't do himself. If he can't do it himself, then any break in the work and he can't get it done himself is going to cause him loss, and there you're not allowed to do that. He thinks you're not allowed to go out and do that unless he can find other people to do it for him. So that would be true of a strike as well. Because in his time, he says, that's what's going on. So he said, if he want to know, so what are the employees supposed to do? He says they can take them to court, or he says they can have a union, right? They can have an Irgun Poalim. The problem with his saying that is that one of the things the Irgun Poalim does, that a union does, and a group of workers does, is they go on strike if they have to. So he doesn't talk about this, but I think there's a difference. He would make a distinction between a strike in which, once the contract isn't signed, they stop working because their contract is up, their term of employment is up, and they're now not officially employed by this person, so they don't work for that person. That would be, I think, a different kind of a strike. Whereas the strike that he's talking about is we have a current contract, we're just not happy about something in the conditions of work, so we go out on strike. He says he thinks that's unacceptable, right? It's the same thing as I think, you know, sometimes in baseball, people like sit out. They don't come to spring training when they're still under contract because they want to renegotiate their contract. So I think that, he would say, is completely unacceptable because they're under contract. That's what I think he means. But if you have a contract that comes to an end, and that wouldn't be a strike. That would be, I'm not going back to work, even though the assumption is that I'm going to stay in this job once the contract gets signed, and that would be it. But he says you have a group of workers. He goes to the whole thing about groups of workers can band together and make rules, and those rules become the rules for the workers. And that's how you get things like health insurance and disability insurance and life insurance and all those kinds of things. They come from having a strong union of workers, which is in favor of unions, and the unions can say, and we won't sign contracts, then you won't have laborers, and no laborers will come to work for you. That he thinks it's acceptable, right? You can make rules about what you're willing, but once you're under contract, once you're working for somebody, that he thinks you can't do. But he doesn't think, he said, that an employer can fire people who go out on strike unless they cause him loss. If they cause him loss, he can fire them. So it gets complicated because he just said they're always causing him loss. They're causing him some loss. The question is what level of loss they would cause him that would allow the employer to fire striking employees. But basically he thinks that if you hire people, you're required to keep them on for the length of the contract unless they damage the owner. And even then, he thinks you have to warn him and you have to give him a chance to change, stuff like that. But just the fact that the employee is kind of lazy and doesn't do the work quite right, he doesn't think that gives the owner the right to fire him, which the whole another issue, but we're already out of time, so I just want to finish up a couple of last points. So I'll leave that for another time. But basically, he thinks that employers don't really have the right to fire people except for a really serious cause. And the last point we'll do, and I've skipped a couple of points, the last point we'll do is he says he thinks that an employment contract or an agreement to give employment, which wasn't given a time, and it's being paid monthly, he thinks either side can demand the change in conditions at the end of each month. So depending on how often you, in other words, he's saying that if they didn't specifically say, if it's an open-ended thing, I'm hiring you, and I'm hiring you. So he thinks that at the end of every, he seems to think that at the end of every payment period would be a time for renegotiation. Now, you wouldn't renegotiate then. You'd start negotiating before the payment period. And then you might say, and give your 2 weeks notice or your month notice, right? Whatever your notice is for your next payment period. And that would be the way you'd work it out. So these are some ideas that Uziel had for the 4th of Tevet of 1937 of Tuf Reish. We'll say it as Katzadi, but Ravuziel didn't feel the need to, about employer-employee relations and how to build, as he's hoping for, let's remember how he started out, a mutually productive and mutually affectionate relationship between employer-employees, where everybody respects each other, where everybody gets their needs filled, and where they work together to build a true endeavor in agriculture, in business, in construction, in industry, and that for them also was part of building up Eretz Yisrael. Responsible day for the 4th of Tevet. Have a great day.